You're listening to Episode 6 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
David, we have quite a lot of stories to talk about this week. Hope we have time for all of them. What do you think we're looking at?
Well, let's see. We're going to have a Reaper turned into a jammer. Drones spying on not people, but chickens in Australia. The FAA rules for small UASs are delayed again. The UAV privacy questions remain. In the United Kingdom, we have a new UAS test center. Monitoring wildlife with a puma and weather with a global hawk. FEMA shuts down Colorado UAV flights supporting the floods in Boulder. And more multi-rotors coming down in crowds. So our first story, folks, is the Reaper becomes a jammer. The MQ-9 Reaper, which is becoming the drone or UAV for the United States military and the Air Force, back in August flew with jamming pods that would normally be seen on an EA-18 Growler or a EA-6B Prowler. So as part of a joint WTI, or Weapons and Tactics Instructor course with the Marines. So they're trying to expand the role of the Reaper. The Reaper definitely is a armed drone capable of carrying laser-guided bombs as well as Hellfire missiles. But in this case, they want to add jamming pod. You'd have an aircraft being able to fly into a hot zone like the EA-18 Growler and jam local frequencies. And it could be operated closer to the zone and you could work with friendly forces on the ground. So it's definitely an expansion of the role of the Reaper.
David, is this a pod that's used in other applications, do you know, or is this something that's specific for the Reaper?
The pods are designed for the EA-18 Growler and the EA-6B Prowler have pods that hang on the wings. They look like fuel tanks, but really they are electronic bays that you can, and usually a Growler will fly with four across, so two on each wing to give room for fuel tanks, and as well as out on the wings, there would be defensive weapons. What they are is each one has got a little propeller on the front of it, and it's designed to jam specific frequencies. So you have a row of battery of four different jamming pods. They each one will pick a frequency of an anti-defense radar, or so. In this case, it would be one frequency on each wing or two pods, as well as the equipment too, in case they do find a hot thing like a surface-to-air missile site. They could use the Hellfire missiles to jam it as well as blow it up.
I assume that means that the Reapers with this kind of capability would pretty much be able to do what manned aircraft have been doing so far.
Yes, it will be able to do the capabilities, but it would be doing half of the capabilities. The sophistication of the EA-18 Growler has jamming equipment throughout the airframe as well as the additional pods. The Reaper won't be able to have the payloads, but if you needed an immediate close air support or in a high threat area, it's better to send in someone without a man than it is to send in a manned aircraft. So it will probably find a niche role, but it will expand the electronic countermeasures force, because right now we don't have the Air Force doesn't have any whatsoever. We gave that up with the EF-111s, and now it's pretty much the Navy's role with the Growler, the Prowlers being quickly phased out due to age. So this will be an expansion and broadening it out so you're not overstressing the Growler fleet.
Let's swing in a completely different direction, and we see some activists in Australia who are using a hexacopter for a very interesting application, aren't they, David? They're concerned that some of the large free-range chicken farms are, in fact, not really free-range farms. So they're using a hexacopter here to help make their case, aren't they?
Yeah, it's kind of strange to hear activists using drones for their own good. Usually it's the activists are against the drones. Yeah, a $14,000 copter with a $3,000 high-definition camera, stabilizers, and a 10x zoom lens. So the aircraft flies over and is trying to prove that the free-range chickens really aren't free-range, which means they're either in cages or small farms and they're not able to roam freely, which you pay more for a free-range chicken. So these farmers, according to the activists, are committing fraud.
Now, the farmer is, of course, not too happy with this, and it raises some issues about the legality of flying over someone's property like this. This is a topic that has come up, you know, many, many times. In fact, goes all the way back to the beginning of aviation, doesn't it, David? When airplanes first started flying, up to that point, the common law view had always been that you own the column of air above your property. Of course, airplanes flying through that column of air changed all that. They had to take that into account with aviation, and now we have to look at it from the standpoint of drones.
Well, I mean, it goes even beyond airplanes. There is a reason why a hot air balloon, and one of our co-hosts on one of the other show, Grant McCarron, is a balloonatic, you carry a bottle of champagne in the basket, because when you land on the farmer's farm, so he doesn't abscond with your balloon, you provide him a bottle of champagne as thank you for providing ground and help. So that tradition always is carried on, and I was actually fortunate to have that happen when I was a young kid. We had a hot air balloon land into our backyard, which for me, it was like really cool. I could help fold the balloon, right? It was free labor, but my parents reaped the benefits of the bottle of champagne. So back to being drones, you have an aircraft that legally can fly over the farm. But the question is, if you're taking pictures of what's below, where that line gets blurred. And part of the article that we have, the farmers are not actually against pulling out their shotguns and taking a couple of pot shots at the helicopter or quadcopter flying over their backyard.
Right. Now, obviously, neither you nor I are attorneys, and so we really can't offer any specific legal advice, but just based on what we see on this topic, there are a couple of legal issues. There's the issue of trespass, there's the issue of nuisance, and there's the issue of privacy. And I think, David, that in future episodes, we can examine those in more depth than we can right now. But on the topic of trespass, in the United States anyway, the operator of an airplane, has the ability to overfly someone's property legally as long as you're flying at an altitude that's not so low as to disrupt the activities of the property owner. That starts to become the nuisance. And then there's the issue of just privacy. Is it an invasion of privacy? And all of these things are different in different jurisdictions and different countries. So I don't think there's one universal answer to all these. And in some cases, the case law is fairly well defined, and in others, that case law is still developing.
Clearly, you can't take your Cessna and go buzzing or trying to go tip cows with it. That's definitely a nuisance. In this case, it's another case where a lot of times law needs to catch up to the technology. Mm. Technology is way ahead. And things like what we were talking about was a $14,000 drone, but more importantly was the $3,000 camera with the 10x zoom. So the question is, you might not even need to overfly that person's yard. You could be flying somewhere else, and with a 10x zoom, you could do all of the photography that you need to prove the point that the chickens are being cooped up. The article does say that the drone owners, the activists, won't be prosecuted because there's really nothing they can prosecute about. But the only way currently, as well as far as what we've read about U.S. law, now we're not Australians, so we won't speak to that. But U.S. law, if for some reason the hexacopter then proceeds to crash into the chickens, then there's a trespassing thing, and then there may be an argument, or suddenly the chickens won't lay eggs because they keep hearing a drone fly over. So you have to prove some sort of causal effect that the drone is hurting the environment or affecting the environment. Right. And in this case, it didn't happen. They just took pictures.
Yeah, and the pictures showed in the video, in the article anyway, it didn't show any chickens outside, although subsequently some video was made that did show the chickens outside. So I guess it's still kind of an open question as to whether this is a free-range operation or not. But kind of the important takeaway is that it's, you know, yet again another interesting application for UAVs, for drones. And the legal issues surrounding this are, again, some of them are settled, but some of them are not quite yet. And as we said before, we'll spend a lot of time talking about some of those points in future episodes.
It's going to be a journey for us. The more we do this, the more we realize how little we know and how quickly what we do know has changed. So we're going to keep working on that. Speaking of changes and delays, the first commercial UAS flight due and the small UAS rule. We talked about the FAA approving the in situ Scan Eagle. And it looks like, Max, that while the FAA approved it to fly, it still hasn't yet.
Yeah, they're looking to make this the first commercial flight of an unmanned aircraft under the FAA authorization to do that. And ConocoPhillips was planning to launch their Scan Eagle from a research vessel. This is in the Arctic Ocean up around Alaska, so it's kind of in an area, in an environment where if something goes awry, there isn't much to be harmed. And they're going to use this to monitor whale migrations and ice flows. So the initial flight was scheduled for September 11th. I guess we don't really have word as to whether or not that happened yet, or if they've had multiple flights. So we're still waiting to get that word from ConocoPhillips. But that's, you know, it's the start. It's the beginning of the sort of era of commercial applications.
Yeah, and why would an oil company want to find out about migrations and ice flows? Because they want to drill in that area. So it's they're trying to get the details down so they can drill safely and not affect whale migrations or worse, have an ice flow take out a rig in the middle of the Arctic Ocean. So the FAA releasing them to do it is one thing, but clearly they're not in any hurry to get out the regulations so everybody else can't, because basically ConocoPhillips was given a special operator's license, like we talked about, for the Reaper over California. So the FAA release of the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, or NPRM, would govern the operation of SUASs, which is small unmanned aircraft systems, weighing 55 pounds or less. And it's been delayed to early 2014. Clearly, it's been going on for a while, and it keeps getting pushed back further and further. So the FAA is taking their time, and I think maybe that's not a bad thing for once.
Yeah, that's true, because if they jump quickly, they may make some decisions that are not the best in the long run. So we've seen some delays. As we've mentioned before, the U.S. Congress directed that the FAA, back in 2008, that the FAA developed the rules regarding these kinds of aircraft, and we don't have that yet. This NPRM that David mentioned, Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, is a process that the FAA uses where they will draft up some regulations, some rules, some proposed rules, and then open those up for public comment. That's the process where all of us, anybody, can get involved in affecting the outcome and the final decisions that are made. Interestingly enough, the initial standards that the FAA has been using came from ASTM International. The FAA kind of subcontracted out to ASTM International the task of drafting the first pass at the rules. And we have another article from Inside GNSS, which is a pretty comprehensive article. It covers a lot of ground. As with all these articles, we'll have links in the show notes. But this is something that everyone might want to take a read of, because it really delves into a lot of interesting issues. But back to the standards, there were two ASTM, or there are two ASTM committees, subcommittees. One dealing with small UAS and one dealing with large. what we're talking about now and what the FAA is trying to move towards releasing is for the small unmanned aerial systems. A separate committee for the large systems had been chartered and was operating, but apparently they ran into some difficulties. Life became kind of complicated, and they weren't making much progress. So that's actually been kind of put on hold. The committee still exists, but they changed their charter to one where they're looking at minimum operational performance standards, or MOPS, for detect and avoid equipment. But as we mentioned, there's been a delay. They have to take all into consideration some of the privacy issues that we mentioned have been affecting the ability to kind of close on this. And so now the FAA is thinking that it's going to be more towards the beginning of 2014 before we see the proposed rules and have an opportunity to comment on them.
We actually on Airplane Geeks actually had someone from ASTM, and it was a very interesting process that they go through, and getting a bunch of people in the room talking about stats and statistics and weights and measures, and it probably is not everybody's cup of tea, but it's a very time-consuming and sort of tedious. So let's be thankful for once that we're not rushing the judgment, because we don't want to offend all of our pilot friends and getting this wrong. So I'm okay with the FAA being slow on this one.
As far as the FAA granting authorization to begin operation, like we've seen in a couple of cases, the requirements that they've laid down seem to be pretty good, I think. For example, the UAV pilots have to have a second-class airman medical requirements. Those have to be met. They have to follow the same drug and alcohol rules as pilots do. UAVs cannot be used for pursuit, and they can only be flown during the day with visual contact and under 400 feet. They also cannot fly over people or roads that are heavily trafficked. And interestingly enough, a separate observer has to be available, is required at all times to monitor the operation of the UAS. So those are good, I think, sound requirements given where we are these days.
One of the interesting ones that I think about it is the separate observer. It means that they've thought out the fact that somebody who's flying a drone probably is staring at a laptop more than he's actually watching the actual aircraft fly. So having a separate observer is thinking outside of the box that, yeah, you need an extra pair of eyes beyond just operating the craft. You need to be able to watch it in the airspace. So that's pretty interesting.
Okay, moving over to the UK. David, we see two airports that they've launched a national aeronautical center to develop, test, and demonstrate unmanned aircraft systems for both military and commercial.
Yeah, they're making airports for drones, which we in the United States are working on. We've got quite a few states that are applying for facilities to be able to fly and test drones, but the UK actually beat us to it. Northwest Wales Airport and New Quay Cornwall Airport have launched the NAC to develop. And basically, they're normal airfields, but they will have a operating airspace around them so that people will know that they can fly drones pretty much uninterrupted to test the military drones as well as civilian ones. The UK is trying to get a head start on being flight test centers like we would have at Edwards or Patuxent River or some of the other flight centers that are done for the civilians. So, but for drones or UAVs.
Right. And it's good to see, like you say, David, that others besides the U.S. trying to develop the capability and the regulations and requirements that go along with that. So it's good to see the folks in the U.K. doing the same.
Yeah, and it does provide a, quote, playground for the people. You know, you are confining the testing in a space where you're not interfering with the day-to-day operations of other airports. So this is, I don't know, can we call them drone ports? I mean, what would we call them? Remotely operated airfields?
Yeah, we need a good name.
We need a good name, but it's definitely realizing that they're here to stay and we need to build an environment that we can test them safely where we're not interfering with the general flyways.
Right.
previously in an earlier episode, we talked about drones being used to survey mosquitoes in pools of water in Florida. Well, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has pulled a Puma UAS to fly over and survey the Everglades.
Now, the Puma is a 13-pound vehicle, 9-foot wingspan, something that can be hand-launched, so it's small, and its batteries are able to support flight for up to about 2 hours. And they're using this because they can fly low and slow and cover a lot of territory in an effort to monitor wildlife in the Florida area without disturbing them.
Yeah, well, I mean, the advantage of the Puma is it's battery-operated. So that it's not gasoline powered, so you don't have a buzzing engine flying overhead to disturb the wildlife. You've got a fairly quiet operating system that they can make very detailed photographs and detailed surveillance without actually disturbing what's underneath them. So you're not scaring away the birds, the alligators, crocodiles, and all of the other critters that live in that portion of the world.
Now, something you can't scare away, at least I don't think so, is the weather. And we see that NASA has a couple of Global Hawks, and they're using them to fly over hurricanes, in this particular article, Hurricane Leslie. And this is part of a NASA 5-year mission, the HS3 mission, which is Hurricane and Severe Storm Sentinel mission. And they're using these Global Hawks, which are, I don't know if they're the largest UAV, but they're pretty good size, David.
I think they're the largest UAV currently in production, in mass production. The RQ-4 was built for the Air Force. It has now become used by the Navy for BAMS, which is the BAMS-D program. And NASA owns two of them. They have an endurance of like 24 hours. They have a wingspan of 130 feet. They're huge. They are very capable aircraft that can fly at very high altitudes. They are HAL, high altitude, long endurance. And in this case, they've been flown from Wallops Island in Virginia down the coast into the Caribbean to survey Leslie and this week, Humberto, which evidently is now being classified as a zombie hurricane, which we learned today means that it sort of dissipated, went away, and there was just a little bit left, and suddenly it came back from the dead. What I thought was most interesting about this was the way all of the articles that showed up this week about this portrayed them. NASA had these built specifically for them, but you saw things like spy drone spying on hurricane, or you saw surplus military drones being used for hurricane searching. The press had were in a warped sort of way surprised that NASA would have some drones and using them for something other than dropping bombs or surveillance on people. And every article sort of started off the same way. And it's like, no, folks, these were actually built for NASA. We're going to try to eventually get some of the NASA teams on that have the Global Hawks, as well as they do have some Predators that they use. But they were built with the intention of being used for these kind of purposes. So I'm really not sure why the press can't figure out that there are drones out there that aren't military.
Okay, just moving ahead quickly because we're drawing to the end of our time. We see that in the recent Colorado floods, which have been just massive, a number of folks lost their lives in this very serious and tragic situation, that the Falcon UAV has been used to provide some really valuable aerial imagery to the authorities as they're trying to deal with this flood and locate the people that are still missing. However, David, the FEMA came in, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, finally, and they kind of changed the game a little bit, didn't they?
FEMA came in and decided that the Falcon UAV, which was being flown basically as volunteers, they weren't needed, and they immediately told them to stop flying the aircraft. So a valuable tool that was flying on as a Falcon UAV, which is the company, was saying there were days that they were flying that nobody else was. But FEMA decided that having a drone help them wasn't appropriate, so they canceled them quickly.
Yeah, in fact, they reportedly threatened the Falcon operators and told them that if they were to fly the drones, they would be arrested. I don't know how to interpret this exactly, David, other than to suspect that maybe FEMA doesn't have these kinds of vehicles as part of their process, as part of their standard operating procedure, and so it doesn't know how to deal with them. So I hope if that's it, that you know they soon realize that maybe that wasn't the best way to deal with the situation.
Yeah, I mean, FEMA has to have a command and control structure. They're dealing in a crisis situation. And these guys were, I don't want to say going rogue, but they were trying to do the right thing. But in a way, they were working outside of the control structure that FEMA was trying to set up. So I can understand that this is not the best time to integrate a UAV into a FEMA project structure, but also the fact that, you know what, it was working really well and they were helping, and maybe sometimes you need to look beyond that.
All right, and to finish up, we talked previously about the UAV that came down into a crowd in Virginia recently and injured a few people, and we've seen a couple other crashes as well. One was a hexacopter that came down into a crowd in Spain. And there's actually some video showing that several people apparently were injured. No word at this point on what caused that drone to drop down into the crowd. And there's another one recently, sort of had a political component to it.
Yeah, German Chancellor Angela Merkel had a hexacopter fly into her, basically, her press conference by the Pirate Party, which is a political party, activist party in Germany. They were showing her what it was like to be spied on, and what happened was it basically crashed into the dais that the chancellor and some of her cabinet were standing next to. Nobody was hurt, but they were trying to prove a point, and it's kind of funny because much of the comments were made because Angela Merkel isn't often smiles, or she's a very serious woman, and there were a lot of photographs showing her watch this hexacopter buzz around her with a grin on her face, and then getting great joy when the thing crashed. So again, tonight we've actually had activists using drones instead of going against drones, which is new, as far as new to me. I don't know about you, Max, but it seems like the world is sort of changing in the right direction.
Things have sort of turned around. And another point that occurs to me is that almost anybody who can afford it can get a hold of one of these and fly it. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they've been trained or that they have the experience or the knowledge to operate them safely. So it's likely that we may see some more accidents like this, and it won't really advance the use of drones in these kind of applications in a very healthy way. So that's something to watch for.
Real quick, we got to give a couple of shout outs. Jesse, we got your email about AUSA and we appreciate it. And Cameron, we also got your email and we want to say thank you for sending it. And Max, if somebody wants to give us a shout out or something, how do they go about doing that?
Couple of ways. You can write us. Our email address is feedback@theuavdigest.com. Of course, we're also on Twitter. You can send us a tweet. We're at UAV Digest. You can place a comment in the episode post on our blog. That's theuavdigest.com. And of course, there's also a Facebook page we have, facebook.com/UAV Digest. All right, David, I think that's about it for this episode.
Yeah, time flies when we're having fun. So I guess I will see you next week. And to all of our listeners, thank you for listening.